It's running a little late this evening, so I'll go ahead and call to order the meeting for Tuesday, June 26th, 2012, of the Board of Aldermen.
We do have a charge.
We have a charge tonight.
We have two charges.
We have two charges. One charge.
Two.
Yes.
There's two charges.
Okay.
Rec and Parks.
So, Steve Deere, could you come forward, please, and approach the clerk?
I'll read this to you, and then if you agree, you can sign your name to it.
And Steve Deere was a recent appointee to the Owosso Board of Directors. As a Town of Carrboro delegate to the Orange Water and Sewer Authority Board of Directors, I will, to the best of my ability, exercise all fiduciary responsibilities associated with the position to which I have been appointed and consistent therewith, be an advocate for the Town of Carrboro's sustainability goals and the triple bottom line sustainability principles. Do no harm to the environment and protect natural resources. Adhere to the principles of social justice and equity. And three, return strong stakeholder value. Also, advocate for policies consistent with the adopted town documents, including Vision 2020 and the Carrboro Land Use Ordinance, as well as for any policy positions established by the Board of Aldermen.
And then you can meet the board.
Working with you.
Do we have another charge?
I believe we do, but I'm not prepared for it. But I can be prepared in 2 minutes if you want to move on to the agenda, and I can step out and just get the document ready.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes. Mr. Manager, the consent agenda.
Mayor Pro Tem Coleman and members of the board, there are four items on your consent agenda. Item number one is consideration of approval of a supplemental agreement and capital project ordinance for the Wilson Park multi-use path. Item number two is an award of a construction contract for the Wilson Park multi-use path project. Item number three is a request to authorize the town manager to award a construction contract for Pine Street Phase 1B sidewalk project. And item number four is a budget ordinance amendment for your bond funds, which would appropriate funding for Davie Road and the Wilson Park multi-use path. Mr. Coleman.
Yes. Could I pull four? Yeah. I've got a quick question on it.
Randy.
Yeah, I also wanted to add the proposed merger, a resolution of the proposed merger of the Duke Energy and Progress Energy that is drafted for tonight's review.
This one that's in our place?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That basically would resolve that. We asked the Utility Commission to postpone making a decision on the proposed merger until further study can be completed. Okay, and so that would be an item five, I guess.
That would be five, right.
And Sammy, did you have something on item four?
Yeah, on item four, I just wanted to know, it's mentioned that Davie Road sidewalk construction is projected to be $151,000 less than the prior estimate. I was curious to know how or what that was due to. Usually it's the other way around. This is good news.
Good evening, everyone. The placeholder that was for Davie Road was $651,000, I believe, and that we've had in there for a few years. We now have some preliminary plans done. So we're and a preliminary estimate now from our consultant. So the number is much lower, we think, at this point. And looked at to transfer some funds from Davy Road to Wilson so it can get that one going. So, and yes, I hope we don't have any surprises later, but this is the best we've got better knowledge now than we did when we've, you know, the last few years that I've had a placeholder for Davy Road. So that's the reason.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thanks, George. Lydia, does your motion include the utilities merger resolution?
It can, yes.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Could I just make a point in the utility commission one? You know, one of the issues included in this is that there has been some additions due to the response to the FERC ruling, and part of that is there's been all these deals cut, confidentiality agreements, and those are all secret deals that are done with industrial customers. I just would like that to be reflected in this. Whereas, and I don't have the right wording for it, so if we could hold off and vote on it, and I can work on the wording and include it, we could vote on it later. Is that okay?
Later this evening.
Yes, that would be great, because cool? I'd really, this is, as you
know,
time
and I appreciate it very much for putting this together.
We certainly, you know, want to get our comments in.
Absolutely.
So you all remind us of that
yes.
at the end of the meeting. And so our resolution is for items 1 through 4. Is that correct, Lydia
yes.
and Michelle?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Matter passes unanimously. Before we get on to the next charge, I'm noticing that Bruce Irvin is signed up to speak, but there's not a subject matter indicated. Can you just tell me which item you're wanting to speak to tonight? Okay, we're not. It's on public hearing nights. We don't take comment other than on items on the agenda. So, okay, all right. Thank you. So, Kathy, who's our next charge?
Sarah Ludington.
Is she here?
No.
I didn't see Sarah.
I have the wrong person. I'm still not able to find it.
Come on up. Put your name. Tell her how to spell your name.
And wrong. Handle, are you wrong?
Okay.
Nice to meet you. We've talked and emailed back and forth. I apologize for the confusion. Rom was a recent appointee to the Recreation and Parks Commission. As a Recreation and Parks Commission member, I will, 1, advise the Board of Aldermen and Town Administration concerning, A, the acquisition of real or personal property to be used for park or recreation purposes and the maintenance and use of all town-owned, leased, or operated parks and recreational facilities, B, the operation of all recreational programs, and C, future needs for the acquisition of additional recreation facilities or the expansion of recreational programs and alternative means of acquiring such facilities or operating such programs. And 2, report to the Board of Aldermen as requested by the Board and undertake such studies or perform such duties as the Board may request from time to time. Thank you, and then you can leave the board. Thanks.
Sorry for the confusion. Look forward to working with you.
Mr. Manager, item B1, please.
Okay, item B1 is a public hearing for Jordan Lake New Development Rules Ordinance. And I'd like to point out to the board that you do have at the dais is an alternative resolution. But Randy Dodd will make the staff report.
Good evening. Purpose of this item is to consider a text amendment that's in response to state requirements for Jordan Lake rules. This is just a summary of all of the Jordan Lake rules. The ones in green are ones the town has already dealt with from a regulatory perspective. The ones in yellow are the ones that are the most active in our consideration right now. both dealing with new development and existing development. And the sort of orangish-yellowish one is we're going to refer to tonight. So this is what we'll be talking about. I just wanted to give some context for the bigger picture. This new development text amendment is required by state statute. We brought this to you in a draft form last September. Subsequently, the State Division of Water Quality staff reviewed it, and we worked back and forth with them and made some modifications to the draft ordinance. And they took it to the North Carolina Environmental Management Commission in May, who approved our draft ordinance. And the state is requiring that we adopt the ordinance by this August. Important points for the ordinance are that it limits the amount of nitrogen in runoff to 2.2 pounds per acre per year and phosphorus to 0.82 pounds per acre per year. I'm guessing those numbers don't mean a whole lot to you all without some context. Let me mention that a background condition is for nitrogen, well, for both of these, is about half of what's shown here, or maybe a little bit less than that. These are also the most stringent requirements recognized anywhere in the state. And to give you a little bit more point of reference, nitrogen and runoff from untreated and runoff from highly developed urban areas can be as high as in the order of 20 pounds per acre per year. So this is, you know, a substantial reduction that's required by these rules. In our ordinance currently, the primary standard we have for water quality treatment is for total suspended solids, and we require an 85% removal. And so this requirement will go substantially. I believe most people practicing stormwater management say that this will go substantially beyond what's required for just for total suspended solids treatment. And furthermore, the treatment methods that are used to satisfy this requirement and these load reductions, both the on-the-ground practices that are used and the calculation methods to calculate compliance with this must meet state standards. So there's a North Carolina Division of Water Quality Best Management Practice Manual that is used to identify the stormwater practices to comply, and then there's a new tool out that I'll talk a little bit about to actually do the reduction calculations. And in terms of the applicability of these standards, it's essentially, with some minor modifications, this would apply to projects just as it has in our current ordinance. And I put the little asterisk here to remind myself that a question came up about the applicability to the Winmore daycare situation, as the draft ordinance included some language about that. We had essentially drafted language specifically for the daycare prior to the daycare's approval, and that included meeting a reduction standard similar to this standard here for 2.2 pounds per acre per year nitrogen and 0.82 pounds per acre per year for phosphorus. So that applied to that project. And the reason it was included as in this material for this text amendment is we struck a line in there that had this exact same requirement. It just would have been redundant. But so there's no special consideration for daycare projects other than just making that minor amendment for clarification. There is also an option included per the state statute, the state rules, that allows for off-site offsets. And basically the way that this works is that an applicant, a developer, could choose to treat to a less stringent standard than the numbers I just showed you and make a payment based on the difference between what they treat to and that standard. And that payment, there's some details about how that works, and I'll try to cover also some comments that have come in. It can be to a level of 6 pounds per acre per year, or about, you know, not quite three times as much for single-family detached and duplex development, or 10 pounds per acre per year, between four and five times the amount required for other types of development. And these payments can be made to one of three entities. It can be made to the North Carolina Ecosystem Enhancement Program, to the town if we were to choose to set up a program, get that program approved by the state and fulfill the requirements to offer offer offset options, which basically would mean that we would have projects identified and ready to go where this money could be used to fund those projects, and they could most likely those projects would involve stormwater management treatment, for example, stormwater wetlands or rain gardens or other approved methods of reducing nitrogen and phosphorus from stormwater.
Randy? Yeah. So you're addressing, I guess, the other question that I had, which was whether the administrative code or statute or wherever this requirement comes from, whether it permits us to choose which of those offset payments to offer or whether we're required to give them the choice of all three.
Yes. I didn't have time today to check with the state to see if we have the option of essentially not offering the EEP or the private seller option. So we don't have a definitive response to that. I do would like to say that if the town were in the position of being the sole provider, it would be a significant undertaking for the town to pursue, and one which right at this juncture in time we're not ready to pursue. And so we had short discussions this afternoon as staff, and we're certainly, if that would be the board's direction for us to look into doing that, then we'd be happy to bring back a report on, you know, both on the state's allowability. I'm just not sure if this is a state requirement that we offer all three of these options and the implications for what it would mean for staff.
Okay. I'm certainly happy with the way it is tonight, and I understand that that was one question, one concern I had was how much it would mean to develop such a program or to put the onus on us to be the only offset option. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's the short answer is, it's a non-trivial undertaking. It's not something we're ready to do at this moment.
All right, good. Thanks.
And I did want to make a couple other points on this offset program because other questions came up from the planning board in particular. That the Ecosystem Enhancement Program has made it clear that their fee schedule is set by state statute, and we can't change their fee schedule. We can't request that we take higher fees and pay it into their fund. So if any project that's going to be funded by them will be per their fee schedule. And the other point is that by state statute, a private seller, before the EEP can accept a project, there has to be an option for a private seller. So the private seller option can't be taken off the plate for the Ecosystem Enhancement Program to participate. Now and that's all at the state level, just to be clear.
Does that mean that a private seller ultimately would set a kind of baseline fee in as much as if the town were to set a higher bar and we're required to have a private seller and that private seller has a lesser bar, obviously the developer would choose that option over us?
There would certainly be an incentive for them to do so. It is my understanding that the private sellers have to be state certified, so there's state oversight for their whatever they're doing.
And do we know what standard the state requires of the fee that those private entities must as a baseline charge? I mean, how low could they go?
I haven't asked questions about the specifics of the fee schedule for private sellers, but I know that that the Ecosystem Enhancement Program's fee schedule has been set by state statute, and it requires the Ecosystem Enhancement Program to recoup their costs. They call it the actual cost method, so they basically can't lose money on their program. And I also understand that the private sellers have to be state certified, but I haven't asked the question specifically about if they use the same fee schedule.
Okay. I'd be interested in knowing that if we do pursue that option for the town, it seems relevant to know. We haven't made that decision yet, but if that's an option we pursue. Thanks.
Yeah, and I guess a sort of a fine point on this is this will all play out over time, but we will be, these offsets will all have to be done in the upper Jordan Lake watershed. So basically, projects will have to be identified, and then all developers operating in Orange County and Durham County and little parts of one or two other counties will all be competing for these offset projects, basically. So, you know, a scenario where if we were to set a higher fee, that there might be this idea that nobody would accept that. And yet I can envision a scenario sometime in the future where any project that's viable will be, you know, will be desired, because there'll just be there'll be higher demand for projects than there is availability of projects to satisfy the demand. And that's sort of a nuance, but
seems like that's a, be a market then to reflect that demand and ratchet up the price, not just a first come, first serve.
Just procedural notes to make sure to remind you of, that this is a legislative action. You must hold a public hearing, and that you are required to adopt a statement describing the consistency of the amendment and hence the resolution that's been put before you. And also just a reminder about consistency with Vision 2020. Staff believes that the most appropriate items in Vision 2020 are 5.22 that says Carver should adopt a strategy and set of policies to protect all of our creeks, streams, ponds, and lakes, and 5.23, Carver should be proactive in managing its stormwater, promoting active maintenance of facilities, reducing impacts of increased impervious surface, and minimizing impacts on waterways. So also in the packet, you'll notice that the Planning Board and the Environmental Advisory Board recommend approval of the draft ordinance, noting the Planning Board's reference to the offset program, and as well that Orange County found no inconsistencies with the Joint Planning Land Use Plan. And so the staff recommendation is to consider adoption of the resolution finding consistency and adopt the draft ordinance. So.
Thanks, Randy. So we have one citizen signed up. So you want to ask your question first?
Well, yeah, because we have new attachment A1 at our place, and the difference seems to be in the elimination of Section 1.
That was an oversight, that section should have applied to the second item on your agenda.
Okay, I just wanted to understand what the difference is. Okay.
Megan Culler, would you like to come up?
Actually speaking to the second ordinance, the Stormwater Volume Control Ordinance. My name is Megan Culler, and I'm
okay, so you should take your seat and come back up in a few minutes. Thanks. Yes, that is what it said. I apologize. Any other discussion for the board?
I just was wondering, again, sorry, Randy, this, looking at that table one that's provided, and the mitigation opportunities compared to what this Virginia statewide technical provision standards are, it looks like the Jordan Lake provisions are, there are fewer of them when comparing the two. And so I was wondering to what extent the Jordan Lake rules will expand the opportunities available and or the town.
Yeah. I mean,
that, in the wrong. Position.
Yeah, although sorry, the point is still valid for this item, in that the Jordan Lake accounting tool, I didn't really talk about that too much, but it's basically a methodology that's been developed jointly between North Carolina State University and the Division of Water Quality to do the calculations that test for the ability to comply with this ordinance. And that tool is basically in a beta state right now and will be continued to be improved. The one thing I know, and the second item is just talking about the volume piece. So for the nitrogen and phosphorus, there's also a calculation, the nitrogen and phosphorus reduction. I know that we'll be hearing later this year, there's already been announced workshops out about some new changes to the State Division of Water Quality Manual, and that could be reflected in the Jordan Lake Accounting Tool that address the increased emphasis on permeable pavement as a treatment method that will get more credit than it has in the past for us here. So that's just an example of one way that I'm envisioning, and I'm hearing that Jordan Lake Accounting Tool is not a static tool to do these calculations, and as information comes in with good research behind it to justify expanded options that we could see it evolve to recognize that. But we are, for local government, we are constrained. We don't have a choice about what we can use to as a compliance tool for these.
Okay.
I have a question for Randy. Just so I'm clear. So the advantage for the town setting up its own program would be that the money would go to a restoration project here.
We could have control over where it happens.
Right. But we can't increase it's the same rate as the state charges for the.
We could set whatever rate we choose for our own program. We wouldn't be constrained by.
Okay.
It.
Okay.
But we would be constrained by this private option.
Mm-hmm. Which we're constrained by anyway at the moment. We're going to be anyway. So I mean, I would love for there to be the staff to bring back information about what it would look like for us to set up our own program, given that we have control over where the money goes and how much we charge. Knowing, I heard what you said about how much staff time that might take, and if we actually have our own program, that we're not ready for that now, but I'd love the information about what that would look like.
Yeah, and added to that, I would like us to have a sense of what we're competing against, this private fee structure, and how what's our range of fees we could be making for this.
If we were to set up our own program, would we be able to have incentives in it, such as I wouldn't want to charge people for something that they weren't doing? And so if people weren't loading their property with the things that we want to keep out of the lake, could we then not charge them? It just amazes me that all these regulations are after the fact, and that there's nothing that the state's doing to prevent the use of these things on the lawns and on the grounds, and instead are looking for ways. And the ways really don't make a whole lot of sense to me. That it would be like saying, I can dump a bunch of mud in your yard, and I'm going to pay somebody over here for it. Just doesn't. It doesn't really keep that particular stuff at that particular place out of the water. So would there be any way that we could say, if you are using these, then we will charge you to keep them out. But if you can prove to us that you're not having this effect on the water, then we don't charge you.
This particular provision kicks in for new development. So there has to be a development application that disturbs more than 5,000 square feet for us to look at this. My understanding at this point in time is if we were to choose to have our own program to accept offset payments, that we would have to have that program approved by the state. So we can try to sell to the state something different than their standard way of looking at things, but at this point in time, I don't know if I can guarantee that. It will depend on the details of what we propose.
But it is to keep nitrogen and phosphorus out, right? So if somebody was doing a new development and they could prove to us that what they were doing was not adding nitrogen and phosphorus to the water, then we shouldn't charge them for it.
But under the way the state has it, there's just a presumption that anybody who's disturbing property for development will be adding nitrogen and phosphorus to the watershed. That's really too bad. It's really too bad that there can't be an incentive on the other end. Just like it's really too bad that we can't put a surtax on nitrogen and phosphorus that are used within our town limits, and to have that surtax pay for, just like the tire tax does. But Raleigh hasn't really given us those options, and I doubt if they will this session, so we kind of have our hands tied on that one.
And the offset option is,
that's the presumption,
is for when a developer chooses to not pursue the 2.2 pounds per acre.
Yeah, and we'll have to see how this plays out in terms of how many choose to go all the way to that. A lot of people believe that a lot of developers will find it beneficial to not try to go all the way to 2.2. That's a high bar.
Right. So speaking to Jackie's concern, basically, if a developer does achieve it, then they wouldn't have to pay into the fund, essentially. So
that's correct.
So as the offset's really just available only when, and for developers to have the option, which more likely than not they'll pursue because it's cheaper than achieving the high standard, right? That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, well, cheaper probably, but also I think feasibility is a question for some sites and for some development plans. I mean, it just literally may be next to impossible or impossible to achieve that standard without totally compromising some plan.
Thanks.
I'll move to close the public hearing. And I'd like to go ahead and make a motion, and I'm going to try to incorporate some of what we're saying, if that's all right with everyone.
Well, why don't we? Do we need to close the hearing on this? On the legislative?
Moving on. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously.
Okay, so I'd like to, I think we ought to want to move to adopt the resolution finding consistency.
Second.
Okay, and you're not making any changes to
No, I think I'm going to follow up. Y'all, I think we need to adopt this tonight, and then we need to follow up with this. Mm-hmm. So.
Right, mm-hmm. And that's the modified
attachment
A1.
Yes.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Passes unanimously.
Move the ordinance, attachment A, attachment B.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Passes unanimously.
Okay, and so then I think a motion I'd like to make, and chime in if you want to tweak it a little, but is that we ask staff to investigate having us possibly be the only option for developers to use who want to offset their nitrogen and phosphorus loads if they don't meet the required amount, and that and in doing so, staff can also investigate the possibility of some kind of incentive if they don't reach that amount. Did I say it properly?
Mm-hmm.
Did I say it right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, Randy?
Or an incentive for reducing the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that they are using.
Okay.
Just to have it.
One thing, though, is staff is already telling us that we can't have it just be
right.
The town.
Right.
We have to have a private seller option.
There has to be.
By legislation. So that's the point I'm making.
Right.
If we're required to have this private seller option, then we're really limited by their cost.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to propose amending your proposal to have us look at what the highest private seller option is, and for us to
right.
consider options for payment within that.
Okay. Lydia, you see what he's saying?
Yes, I do.
That's why I asked the question before.
Okay, it's fine. I'll take that friendly amendment.
And Lydia, are you also wanting information on what would be involved in having a town program in the first place.
Absolutely. And I want to emphasize, too, that I think we all understand that this would be some kind of major undertaking. It's something we just want to have investigated, but we wanted to go ahead and get this passed mm-hmm. tonight. But I know it would require some investigation, but I think the points we've raised are really valid. So.
It's an absurd situation to be in.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. Item B2.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem Coleman and members of the board, the second item public hearing is for a land use ordinance text amendment related to stormwater volume control. And again, Randy Dodd will give the staff report.
This item has been brought to you in a different set of circumstances. It is not being brought to you because there's a state requirement for us to do so. It's being presented for other reasons. One of those is that this is something staff has had on our radar as something to consider for a while now, and we've been studying the new development requirements for Jordan Lake and looking at our own ordinance, and we recognize that even with the provisions just looked at, that there's still an environmental concern that's sort of slipping through the cracks with our management of stormwater volume. And the real issue here is, and I'll show a slide or two in a minute that graphically depicts this, is this our interest in managing the total runoff volume. We are controlling for volume when you consider the peak flow, the highest flow during the storm event, but this takes it further. And why is this important? It's important, really, for two environmental reasons. And one is that when we don't control for the total volume of runoff, what happens is that the groundwater doesn't get recharged as fully, and we also have more risk of damaging the actual stability of our stream channels and having more stream channel erosion occur. We're also bringing this up tonight because we're recognizing sort of a movement that's, I'd say, a national, if not international, movement, and increased interest at a statewide level. In the staff memo, there's lots of reference to things that have happened, for example, in the Chesapeake Bay region and states, and here locally, there's growing awareness. Chapel Hills had a provision in their ordinance. This was brought up at a symposium that occurred earlier this year, and there was lots of local discussion and interest in this topic, and so we just thought it was timely to do some research and think about this. So graphically, to sort of present this, this is a slide that was borrowed from the symposium that happened this past February from Kimberly Brewer. She worked for Tetra Tech, and she's been doing work nationally. I've seen other examples of very, very similar presentations. And basically what happens in a generic development kind of scenario is that the amount of rainfall that runs off when you look at pre-development conditions versus post-development conditions without adequate volume control treatment is you flip the amount that runs off versus what infiltrates. Instead of a relatively small percent running off and a good portion infiltrating into the soil profile, half or more of the water runs off and very little actually infiltrates. Now, this is just a generic, and obviously there's a lot of variability for different sites, but this is conceptually what the nature of the problem is. Another way to look at it, we're looking here at what is called a hydrograph, and let me just explain what we're seeing here. Over on this side, this is cubic feet per second. This is a way of measuring the flow, the amount of flow leaving in a given time. And then what's happening here is we're having a rainfall event. So here at 10 o'clock, it isn't raining, it starts raining during the course of this day, and then somewhere in the midday, early afternoon, it stops, or around lunchtime, it stops, and then gradually the runoff goes back to a baseline condition. So the red line here is showing the pre-development or undeveloped condition. The green with the big spike here is showing what happens if we don't treat that. And then the blue line here is showing what our ordinance and almost all ordinances require. It requires peak control. So we brought this peak back down to the same level as it was prior to. But what you'll see here is there's this volume here. And so, you know, basically what our ordinance requires is that over a course of hours or a few days after a storm, that these peak flows be drawn down so that when the next storm arrives, we're ready to hold those and treat for the peak flow. To give you an idea of the 2-year 24-hour storm, that's about 3.5 inches of rain, and this is the amount that Chapel Hill requires volume control for in their ordinance. And I just think even, you know, even intuitively or conceptually, most of us can understand that if we get a 3.5-inch rain here in one day, that to completely infiltrate or treat for that volume is a very, very high standard and very difficult to achieve. So what we've done is proposed approach that's a little bit different. It's fortuitous that this Jordan Lake accounting tool has just been developed. And it uses a little bit different method than the design storm method. It's based on an annual precipitation. So we're looking at the total annual volume of water that is predicted using this tool. And from it, we've set a not-to-exceed amount that increases a percentage of the pre-existing runoff. This allowable increase is based on the soil's hydrologic condition. This is a standard thing that's included in soil surveys and in soils data, and on the level of pre-existing development that exists on site. And this is all captured in a single number that's known as the curve number. And basically, the thresholds that we've recommended have been, it's a little bit unique what we've done here. Instead of just having a conceptual basis for our ordinance, we've actually run this tool on 4 different sites. We've run it on 2 sites, and applicants have run it on 2 other sites. And we've looked at those results and basically tried to have a sort of a, you know, a best version Carbaro calibrated estimate of what would be an appropriate way to set these thresholds. And this is what it looks like this is actually the essence of the ordinance is allowing these amounts of percentage increases in the annual stormwater runoff volume. I did want to make note here that we found a little inconsistency in that, and we would like to say that if you are interested in acting on this tonight, that we would actually like to change this number to 65 and this to 71. Since we say less than or equal to here, and just so that we don't have, you can't. What do you do if you have the number 70? I mean, you have to have
70, that one or 79.
Yeah, you have to. So that's just a little detail there. These are the 4 sites we applied the Jordan Lake accounting tool to, and the essence of the results. And the percentage change that's predicted by the Jordan Lake accounting tool is shown in this column. And the bottom line here is that the Claremont site plan that was approved a few months ago, we ran that through the Jordan Lake accounting tool and found that it, when you compare that to the tables here, you know, it's greater than any of these numbers. So, you know, it wouldn't be compliant, and something additional would had to happen on that site to meet the requirements. We believe that, you know, there have to be more work to be done to say exactly what could be done to comply with that. but we believe it's not an unachievable standard. It would just require some more careful stormwater management planning. In contrast, the Family Dollar site, where they basically took a completely undeveloped forested site and completely developed it, it's probably not possible for them to get to either a 200 or 400% increase on that site just using stormwater management improvements. It's just too much.
It's 1,170% of the current max volume, is that right?
It's 1,170% increase.
Increase over?
Oh, from the undeveloped condition.
Right.
So, and I'd have to look at the numbers to see exactly what the predicted stormwater volume was before and after, but it, you know, it's a.
But it's a key point that, that the family well, for example, that so-called Family Dollar lot is currently just wood, just woods, whereas at CVS, there's a lot of impervious surface
that's
there
right.
already.
That's right.
That's exactly mm-hmm. right.
And that's basically, you know, the rationale for this tiering, this greater than 78%. Curb number recognizes that that site that recognizes the amount of existing development that exists on that site that on a site.
But so, but what does it all mean? What does it all imply in terms of? So what? Go back to the other slide. So it says, for example, CVS 34%.
So they were in this case the CVS site. Over in the far right there, it says compliant with the draft ordinance. It's staff belief that site would be compliant because they would be meeting this standard here. It will, any one of them, they'd be compliant with that. No one would possibly fall into that category there.
So 64.
Since they have a 34% increase, that's less than 50%.
Right.
So, you know, they're having a relatively minor increase. And in their site plan, they are adding some impervious surface, but they're also doing a fair amount of there's currently no stormwater treatment on that site. So they're adding bioretention areas and rainwater harvesting and other things I think those are the two main ones that would minimize the amount of additional volume that would be.
So I apologize for not sort of getting this regulation at a kind of an intellectual level, but since hopefully you do, you can help me out here. It seems like you're saying, well, since CVS, and I don't mean to pick on CVS or that particular site, and by the way, so that people who are following along, there's many other issues that CVS will have to face in order to be considered later on. So this is only one minor issue. But picking that example because it happens to be right downtown and happens to be, you know, heavily impervious surface already. Are we sort of letting them off easy with a regulation like this? In the sense that. I mean, we're sort of saying, well, since this site's been polluting for a long time, mm-hmm. we're going to hold it to a lower standard. That's really what it amounts to.
I guess that would be one way of phrasing it. I mean, the way I
just... Sorry, I don't mean to be too negative. I'm just trying to make sure I really understand what the implication is here.
That's a good point.
When you look at this, if you were to try to achieve a 50% standard with some disturbance on one of these sites here, it would be harder to do. It would be harder to do that because you're going to be adding new disturbance that's going to automatically have some...
You'd have to build like you were in the watershed or something.
Right.
Maybe go back to that image of the... The pictures?
Yeah, the recharge and the infiltration.
The infiltration pictures?
Tetra Tech.
Sorry.
Yeah,
that one. So it's a difference.
You see the difference, Mark?
Uh-huh.
Basically, you know, with a site that's got a lot of existing development and impervious surfaces, you're going to be starting closer to this range. And so the amount that you can actually, down here, anything you do is going to have a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know, and so you're going to, even if you only go from a relatively low amount, but you ramp up, you're going to, any development you're going to do is going to have a significant impact on the volume.
Percentage-wise. Okay, so that brings me to the other part of my question, which is, does this regulation really take into account basically maybe the idea that this is one idea I could picture, is that various developers who find themselves in various situations with various pieces of land are being asked to carry a similar burden, or no, not at all necessarily? Similar burden either financially or in terms of the amount of overall, you know, carbon or nitrogen that they're being held responsible for. Do you follow what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, what this does is it, you know, we're currently ignoring the volume piece, and this brings it onto everyone's radar.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and it tries to do it with this scale that's calibrated so that it's not partial to any given circumstance. Now, I'll be the first to admit that I think we should look carefully at these numbers, these percentages, and tune this scale as we get more experience. And it may be that we would come back to you. And one of the recommendations that I was going to offer was that we do plan to come back to you in the not too distant future to look at whether these numbers are the best ones, or if we should have a recalibration after we get more experience. So we're proposing these numbers based on basically these four runs of the Jordan Lake accounting tool at this time, and we believe that it provides a threshold in a tool. Really, it provides a tool that the staff doesn't currently have to have developers look at putting in best management practices that are more effective for volume control. And essentially that's the thinking behind this scale as it's been set up.
Are there other questions for staff? Or I
have a question. Randy, so to what extent, I'm trying to understand, this is independent of the Jordan Lake rules, right? This is our attempt to really enforce what is and the intention behind the Jordan Lake rules. And as much as we just saw, people can buy off, developers can buy off an offset, not necessarily implement these requirements on their developments. And this would maybe achieve that. And I understand that these standards are not more than what is in the spirit of the previous ones, in as much as if they were to implement those standards, you would achieve the goals in this ordinance?
So I believe that if an applicant were to meet the 2.2 pounds of nitrogen and the 0.82 pounds of phosphorus, they would go a long way towards doing this. And in many cases, they may achieve this.
Okay,
but
great.
Since there's that offset option, you're exactly right. I mean, this could still remain.
And so a related question is, to what degree the Jordan Lake rules, I guess, allocate a certain amount of pollution from each jurisdiction into Jordan Lake, right? That's maybe an underlying premise I'm imagining. And so I was wondering if we could inform this standard relative to what our allocation is for pollution into Jordan Lake, and by doing so inform our zonings. This relates to this question during our retreat of what standards and factors do we inform the kind of zoning we have in town. What are our limits, in other words, to zoning? And it's not a question for us to resolve tonight, but rather an opportunity for me to put a placeholder and bookmark this as mm-hmm. another thing for us to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Randy, this is kind of following on Mark's point. So it seems to me that a property that is, you know, maybe 80 or 90% developed and it's essentially going to be redeveloped, and if it's been sitting there a long time in its current condition, like, for example, the Narayana building and parking lot are, that the redevelopment poses the opportunity for reduction in the volume. And it may not ultimately be a net reduction, but it seems like 50% is too high in that case. And it seems like this, like the chart you have, this tool in general, is maybe not sensitive enough to the opportunities for reduction using our newer understandings than what we had 30 or 40 years ago as properties are redeveloped. So I guess in raising this point, I want to be clear, are you suggesting that we adopt this ordinance tonight and that that's something you want to continue to explore, or, you know, just we'll have something on the books, or is that something that, you know, it would make sense for us to ask you to come back to us with some refinement if the board was interested?
Our, as we've been developing this, our general intention for tonight was to get this issue, you know, get some good thinking from you all and from others in the community and from ourselves targeted on this. I believe that what we have here is a very positive step and will give us a tool that between now and any time that we were to even improve it further, that we would have that tool available to us. So, you know, we are recommending adoption, and at the same time, and in our discussions, one of the things we talked about was should there be even another threshold that would allow even less or no volume control increase. But as the saying goes, the perfect can be the enemy of the good, and we also were concerned about putting up some standard that we hadn't fully tested that would be a real barricade. I mean, we just, you know, and so that's why these numbers are where they are. But speaking for myself personally, I think staff would be happy to investigate the scenario that you're talking about and looking at that.
Okay, thanks.
At that. Another threshold.
Mark, you have one citizen signed.
Yeah, I'm going to recognize Randy and then Megan Culler. Thank you.
Randy, I want to tell you how much I appreciate the work that went into this to create a unique response for Carrboro and looking at the total volume over the peak. I think that this is, I think it's complicated, but I think, over time, as the Jordan Lake rules are put into place, it's going to make a lot of sense to do this in small steps like this. So I just want to say I appreciate it, and I think these slides that you used were excellent at getting the point across.
Okay. Megan Culler.
Thank you, Randy.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm a board member with Friends of Rolling Creek, and we're very pleased that Carrboro is considering stormwater ordinance changes that will further protect Boland and Morgan Creeks and their tributaries. We support the town in proceeding with the local stormwater program required under the Jordan New Development Stormwater Rule to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus from stormwater runoff. And likewise, we congratulate and support the town in taking a good first step to address a crucial stream protection component of the stormwater management with our proposed stormwater volume control ordinance. At a February symposium, Cammy Hiller Local Waterways, local watershed professionals identified volume controls as a needed part of local ordinances. There's good evidence that volume controls are necessary and effective at protecting streams. Controlling peak flow and pollutants isn't enough. The amount of impervious surface dramatically increases with development in a watershed, and this results in greater volumes of stormwater entering streams, which impact water quality. Commercial development increases this effect, and if we ignore the total volume of stormwater in our stormwater management plans, we're left with a loss of biological integrity, low stream flows between storms, and depleted groundwater stores. The stormwater ordinance addresses a problematic gap. We do not currently control the total volume of stormwater runoff entering our streams. Currently, we have an ordinance that addresses peak flows, and with adoption of the Jordan Lake rules, we will also have an ordinance to address nutrient pollution. However, because Jordan Lake rules allow developers to make payments in lieu of compliance, they will often not protect our local streams as originally intended. In this instance, the proposed volume control ordinance will provide further protection of our streams. Principal of Creek has asked our technical committee members, Michael Paul, Rob Crook, Dixon Phillips, and Betsy Kemter, to review the proposed ordinances. They made several comments, some of which were similar to the comments made by the planning board. I'll give those to you in a handout. From our discussions with each other and the staff, Friends of Bowling Creek has unanimously come to the conclusion that the ordinance is a good first step, and we urge the board to approve the regulation as written. Many potential projects coming forward for a possible future Board of Aldermen approval can be improved by this ordinance. In light of the many questions that have been raised about this ordinance, as well as the tremendous local resources on the subject, we further recommend that the board establish an action item to revisit all stormwater ordinances in 1 year. As part of this review, we ask that local experts meet with your Environmental Affairs Board in an open process to evaluate the effectiveness of current ordinances, address concerns, and discuss potential improvements. The time to act is now. Despite the imperfections of this ordinance, it is moving in the right direction, and we believe it will promote a healthier environment for our town, including better stewardship of Bowling Creek.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Is there anybody else who came to speak on this matter? All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Board members, is there a motion?
Move the resolution of consistency.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded for the resolution of consistency. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Can we make a point of... So that when this is reviewed in the future, that staff be sure to contact Friends of Bowling Creek as they've requested.
Let's put that into the ordinance, actually it makes sense in the resolution, yeah. Sure.
Is that a friendly amendment?
No. I don't see what that fits there.
There?
Yeah,
there
I think it would be a separate motion.
Okay.
All right. Well, okay. That's fine. We can entertain that in a moment. All those in favor of the motion for the resolution of consistency signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no, passing unanimously.
Move the draft ordinance.
All right, draft ordinance has been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Do we need to tweak that 71 to 78, or is that something that...
Oh, yeah.
That's
right. Says you do.
I'm bringing that. Yeah, with tweaking.
But this attorney has a better idea.
Well, not a better idea, but I think there are three places where you need to tweak it. The 64 on the bottom line, either that needs to be a 63 or the 64 on the next line needs to be a 65.
Right.
And then the 70 needs to be a 71. And then on the top line, well, either it needs to be 71 to 77 and then greater than or equal to 78, or it needs to be 71 to 78 and greater than or equal to 79.
So, okay. Is it possible to be 71 and a half?
Well, I'm sure it is. This is a percentage.
Right. So, I mean, really, you need a greater than sign at every step, or less than, or equal to, or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying.
Somehow we have to make sure we're not going to be having like 278s that fit in either category. Somehow we have to.
Right.
So it could just be greater than 78 in the top.
In the top one, right.
Top box.
Which is what it is.
Get rid of that equal sign there.
Right, okay, so the top one, if the top one is greater than 78.
Get rid of the equal sign.
All right, and then the second range is 70 to 78. So if we made that so that it's greater than 70 to 78, do you see what I'm saying? So that 70 even is in the threshold below. Mm-hmm. And then greater than 64 through 70. And then the last one is less than or equal to 64.
Mm-hmm. Just so we don't have the overlap in the categories that could cause confusion somewhere down the line.
All right. I minored in mathematics. Okay.
Can we read those one more time just to be sure? So the first one is greater than 78.
Greater than 78 corresponds with 50%.
Right.
The next one is greater than 70% up to 78, is 100%. Greater than 64% up to 70% is 200%. And then less than or equal to 64% or 64 equals 400%.
Okay.
That's just, obviously, yeah. You can monkey around with it, but.
Yeah. It's nice to serve with smart people.
Yeah.
That's a nice continuous range, I believe. All right. So is that the motion?
Yes.
And is that the only place that it had a change? Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, and is the seconder okay with that?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, matter passes unanimously. All right.
And I'd like to make a motion to refer some of the points made by our friends at Bowling Creek and our planning staff to some...
And the planning board.
To the EAB for when they review it and that they invite the Bowling Creek folks to when they do that review.
I'll second it.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, that passes unanimously. All right. is there anything else we need to do on this one? No. All right. I believe that brings us to item three, requirements of sign ordinance. Mr. Ray.
Mayor Chilton and members of the board, item number three is a public hearing for a possible text amendment to the land use ordinance related to signage. And Ms. Tina Moon will give the staff report.
Seems like we were just talking about this a few weeks ago. As a quick, you may recall, currently our commercial sign allocations are based on the linear street frontage, and this system has worked pretty well for us traditionally with our one- and two-story and occasionally three-story buildings. Amendments that followed the Vision 2020 process created an opportunity for our first multi-story, multi-tenant projects. As these first developments are coming online, our traditional standards are, the question has come up, are our traditional standards still appropriate for some of these larger projects? Just a few weeks ago, on May 15th, staff presented four options for amending the land use ordinance to address this issue, and the board chose option number four, which is outlined in this final bullet, to establish a new subsection under our existing sign ordinance. This would be under section 15-271. To allow developers to apply for a modification to their conditional use permit, which would be for the approval of a master sign plan, and that would come before you all. Part of the process would require a public hearing. If approved, this new section, I've just kind of outlined some of this, but the bigger steps would indicate that as currently written, and this is attachment B in your packet, this would apply to developments in the B1C and B1G, so this is essentially our downtown districts, These would be projects that require a CUP and that are intended to be occupied by multiple commercial enterprises with one or more buildings that are at least 3 to 5 stories tall. So these are not just for every project. These are for the larger projects. To go in a little further, this would essentially allow an applicant to come before you all to request a deviation from the standard requirements of the signed permit. And it would give you an opportunity to, based on the particulars of the application and its location and the size and so forth of the building, to approve a different sign sign allocations. The way the ordinance is currently written in your packet, signs that were approved with this master sign permit would not have to come back for any additional sign permits, meaning if there were multiple tenants, once the whole sign ordinance was approved, there wouldn't be a need for the individual tenants to come back and request a sign permit.
Just a point of clarification. So the master sign permit would be part of the original CUP, right? It would be part and parcel of that.
The applicant could either go ahead and do this at the same time as their CUP application, or they could come back for a modification.
Right, but it would seem that generally people would probably make that part of their CUP. And it would only be if they got down the road and, like in an incident like we're having now. But in general, it would be part of the CUP along with other things we consider, correct?
They would certainly have that opportunity, yeah.
Okay.
In terms of your general procedural notes, the text amendment is a legislative decision, and you're required to hold a public hearing and go through the consistency statement that you just did. And again, we look at existing approved documents. There are a number of items in the Vision 2020 that speak to our downtown character, the existing fabric, and so forth. The two outlined here, 2.11 and 2.41, seem to be the most applicable to this particular project, this text amendment. This is really the key. I kind of zipped through everything because, to me, this is really the key slide right here for our discussion. As Orange County didn't find any issues with consistency, this did go to joint review the beginning of this month on June 7th. The Transportation Advisory Board didn't have any particular comments at this point. The Economic Sustainability Commission recommended approval but did ask, I think it's a bold point in their recommendation, that the whole sign ordinance be looked at, and I think they're interested in input in that process, should you go that way. The Planning Board and the Appearance Commission had more detailed comments, and all of these are provided in Attachment E. In short, the Planning Board was interested in this provision being applicable to all of the business districts, not just the two downtown. Mm-hmm. And they also felt that there was interest in more an application of more design standards, and so they've actually referred to, in case not everyone remembers it, it referred to the design standards in this document in the very back where they speak to design criteria for signage. The Appearance Commission, by contrast, took a slightly different approach, and rather than design guidelines per se, they were looking more in terms of what would be the approach to kind of get a waiver, if you will, to not have to follow the standard development. So they actually looked at the section in our ordinance, which is section 15-178, the architectural standards for downtown development, where there's a provision should an applicant not wish to follow those quite specific design criteria that they would go to the Appearance Commission to seek relief. So that's what the Appearance Commission asked for in their recommendation. Staff, likewise, after some further discussion kind of in-house and consideration, identified another area that you may wish to consider as a modification, and that had to do with what we just spoke of, the need to come back for another sign permit afterwards. So what staff feels may be a better approach would be for an applicant to come for kind of the overall sign plan would be more a guidance for the whole project. And then, if it was a phased project, as the phases continued, they would come back as kind of check-in points. As they had more information, they were able to refine their sign information a little more. And then certainly, with tenant turnover and so forth, there would be a need to get a new sign permit for those individual tenants
if
there was turnover.
Those would go to the appearance commission.
Those would go to the appearance commission.
Mm-hmm. So the master plan would go before the entire board? Before
yes.
the Board of Aldermen, I'm sorry. And the individual ones, if there was any change, would go to the appearance commission?
That is the suggestion from the appearance commission.
With yeah. the master sign plan, are you suggesting that it would have a level of some detail, or I guess it might just vary project by project?
It could vary project by project. So just to kind
Tina,
of...
I'm just ask one more thing on this. If we wanted to follow your suggestion... Do you have the language prepared this evening to include that in the ordinance?
I did not actually prepare that, which in hindsight I probably should have. But to be clear, and that was going to be my next quick point, should you decide that you would like to go ahead and approve this tonight, you could approve it with the additional suggestion of staff. We could simply strike out the one line, which is 15-171C(d)(3), which is saying that there's no need to come back for additional sign permits. We could simply strike that, and that requirement would kick back in. You could also add the recommendations from the planning board to use the design standards in this. You could incorporate that.
What document is that you're holding?
This is from
two sections here. I can't see it from where you are. Okay, thank you.
Should you wish to incorporate the recommendations from the appearance commission, that we would have to come back with. Because the way the whole ordinance is set up is it offers an opportunity for applications to come directly to the board. So should we change that to have them go to the appearance commission, that would be a change that we would have to come back with.
Dina, Mark, may I I want to be able to streamline and put together the planning board and the ESC and appearance commission. So is there a way that those can be put together that they, you know, will work together harmoniously, the three sets of recommendations? Or are any parts in particular conflict that we need to address?
If you look at...
You know what? This is really convoluted. Can we get to some simplicity here? Michelle and I are both feeling like it's, there are too many different pieces with this.
Well, that's what I'm asking Tina
well,
to kind of distill this.
Many, yeah.
Yeah, I'm losing that feeling that I'm ready to vote on this tonight. But did you get an answer to your...
Tina's...
I'm about to...
I do have somebody signed up to speak.
Can I make a comment? I think it's important to retain the context that the entire reason we're considering this is we have one project mm-hmm. that exists and no projects anywhere on the horizon. That is this three-story plus multi-storefront
right.
proposal. And so I think that by bearing that in mind, that puts us in a position to simplify what we do this evening, and should the need arise in the future to do something more broad,
then we
can do so at that time. But right now, there's no indication that we need, I respect the planning board's input, and I know Damon signed up to speak to this, but I don't see any indication that we need this to apply to lots of different zones. And also, given that the suggestion that Tina's making, that we still have approval for individual signs by the appearance commission, I think that does address their concerns. So I feel like we are actually in a place with the draft ordinance where if we focus on the 300 East Main project, we're actually able to get to where we need to deal with their sign needs.
I'm in agreement with what Dan said, except I want to speak just a minute more about the suggestion by staff that we have the master sign plan and then do the further issuance of permits, have them go through the appearance commission. And that is, I still I'm assuming that this master sign plan, though, would still go through, at least certainly our appearance commission, right? Because their comments in their recommendation to us, as well as some other material here, I hope you all kind of look that over. And they look at these sign issues with an eye that I know I don't. Mm-hmm. And that it's sometimes kind of in the middle of a lot of information that we get. And so I would really like to keep them as involved in this as much as I can, recognizing that we would have final kind of say on it.
Okay. Let's hear from Damon. Is there anybody besides Damon who came to speak on this item?
Tom's here, too. Yes. Did you want to, Tom want to speak? Tom, okay. Tom wants to speak, too.
I'm going.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
She just raised her hand.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hey, so our chairperson couldn't be here tonight, so he's assigned us trustee vice chairs to be here for him. I'm talking about the sign amendment. I do want to clarify that although it is the case that we on the planning board did provide additional comments, we also recommended that you not adopt this draft ordinance. So there was a little bit more than simply providing comments. Our recommendation, as you know, was to consider whether this ought to be applied to other commercial zones. It wasn't clear to us why it needed to be only in certain commercial zones. There are other zones in which you could certainly find multi-story buildings. For example, the B4 that appears out at Carborough Plaza and the Lloyd property. It's currently one of the properties they're looking at for that. The second was that you consider whether it would be important to have some kind of guidance to whichever board is tasked with making a decision about a master sign plan or any sign permit. We were a little worried that you were going to basically place this burden on the Board of Aldermen to make a decision about a pretty substantial deviation from the sign ordinance that exists now without providing the board with any guidance about how to make that decision. There is adopted guidance that exists in the report that Tina showed you that was adopted by this board back in the early 90s, I believe. And I wanted to make the point that that part of the rationale for making this amendment is that there have been changes in the land use ordinance since Vision 21 mm-hmm. 2020 was adopted that now allow higher buildings in the downtown. However, if you read the design guidelines that we recommend to you in our recommendation, those guidelines contemplate higher buildings. So it's not as if they don't apply here. It talks specifically about signage above the second story and so on. So you have some guidance before you that this board has adopted already or a previous board has adopted. And I think it's worth your time to consider that guidance. Finally, maybe this is just me editorializing a bit on our recommendation, but I don't think it's far off. If you do decide to change the procedure, as you just discussed, that it would go more through the appearance commission, similar to the architectural downtown architectural standard, I still think it would be important for you, that board, to have some guidance about how to make a decision about a master signage plan. I think from the perspective of some members of the planning board in recent applications, it's been the case where we haven't always agreed with other advisory boards on whether a deviation from design standards has been appropriate, and I think it might help for all the boards to have some more clear guidance about what standards to use. Thanks.
I think you just Damon. I think you just answered the question I was really asking.
Tom, and then Laura.
I'll just offer up clarifications as well because some of my and rather the opinions of the appearance commission were outlined in that email, which is one of the attachments, and we circulated that and then we submitted it, so it wasn't just my opinion. I think Damon's points are well taken, and those guidelines from the 93 downtown standards are good for us all to focus on whether this becomes part of the CUP process or it's a relief process, or the process gets worked out a different way. I think those are good things to keep an eye on. Lydia's point is well taken. I think that tucking a master signage permit into the CUP approvals process could be problematic, might not be. But I think that, at 11 o'clock at night when you're writing the 16th condition and you get to the sign part, you might be like, yeah, whatever. So mm-hmm. I think there's the risk for that with a big development. I also think there's a timing issue. Some developments that are multi tenant, commercial, bigger projects, they go through the approvals process without knowing who's going to be in the building. They don't know the tenant mix. And it while it's an option for the developer to submit a master signage plan in their CUP, they may not know what the tenant mix looks like. Then at some point later in the process, say they do go through that and they change tenants, the tenant has new requirements for signage. To make that developer or landowner or property owner go back through and get a minor modification of their CUP and require a public hearing just to change one tenant sign seems excessive. So I'm sort of siding with the developer there that that seems like a challenge when what we were trying to offer up was a little bit more of a streamlined process, come back to the appearance commission like all sign permits do, and you know, we'll work with staff to approve or modify what the property owner, the developer wants in terms of signage. With all that said, we definitely recognize and agree with the planning board that the sign ordinance needs some revision. It's a little dated when buildings weren't as high, projects weren't as big, and it doesn't lend itself to large-scale developments because of how it is so restrictive on in terms of street frontage and square footage. So something needs to happen. We just didn't believe that the ordinance amendment, the way that it's written, is the way to do it.
So question, sure. Does the suggestion, that bottom bullet, that the individual signs come to the appearance commission, does that satisfy your concern in regard to, you know?
It does, as long as you as a board and body feel that you have enough guidance, guidelines, information to be and time to be able to approve the master signage permit as plan as part of the CUP process. It seems like that was a good insertion, and that was the first time I'd seen that, and I think we would have acted differently as the appearance commission had we seen that suggestion.
Okay. Because how, you know, the way I understand the master sign plan in this context is that it wouldn't have any particular design of individual signs, but it would merely look at the amount of
size and location,
storefront, the amount of street front, whatever that is,
yeah,
and request, you know, we want these many signs in these many places, and that's what would be approved, and then the actual signs themselves would come to you all.
I think that has the potential to work. I think it just needs to be fleshed out and tweaked. And, it, you know, that timing issue that I mentioned, I think, is exactly part of what's going on here with the 300 East Main project is they're ready to roll forward and get signage approved. Their project does not necessarily fit the profile of how the ordinance was written. And so that's the challenge we have in front of us. We're trying to change the law so one project can move forward. And I'm not sure we have enough data and have enough other projects on the horizon to warrant an ordinance amendment of this scale.
Okay, so my last question for you is, so you're recommending a review of the sign ordinance, and the planning board is recommending the use of this 1993 document, which we also might want to, I think we would want to review it,
right,
before adopting. So would it be your opinion that we could go ahead and move forward on the ordinance tonight, so we can deal with 300 East Main and the hotel's needs to be moving in that regard, and while on a separate track, we're getting those standards ready to be attached to this for the future?
No, I don't think the amendment, the way that it's written, is fully baked, and I think that it needs some deeper, you know, thinking and thoughts about what else lies ahead, what other scenarios might present themselves. Sometimes I think we try to write an ordinance amendment for the needs of one project, and we don't think through all the potential collateral damage or iterations of that. I might suggest you vote down the amendment and propose that, you know, either a new relief process be written as a new draft of that amendment, such like the one that we suggested with the architectural standards. But Damon's right. We need guidelines to attach to that so that we can review a relief application with, you know, the knowledge of what to compare it against. So I'm not suggesting that you move forward with it. I don't know what the solution is to keep 300 East Main moving forward and work with their timing. I don't I don't know what that solution is, but I don't think it's this amendment.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. Thanks.
We have one question for Tina. Can you come up real quick? And then we'll hear from Laura.
Well, it sort of speaks to what both Damon and Tom just said. What happens if, given that we're just talking about this because of 300
East Main,
what happens if we don't adopt this this evening?
If we do nothing.
For this applicant, if we do nothing, what's the implication of that?
Well, the final, there was another resolution, I think it's attachment C,
yeah,
which requests for you to set a public hearing in September. I guess it would be a question of how much we could accomplish this summer and how soon we could get something back to you to reconsider. So if you felt that you were not comfortable with what's before you tonight and you wanted to postpone, that would, I suspect, be one option would be to leave the, would either be to reject it or perhaps to leave the public hearing open and we, you know, do more research and bring back something.
So if we do nothing tonight, then the applicant simply has to go along with the sign ordinance as it stands now, which limits them to the second floor, right? And, you know, if you look at the pictures that we have of Hampton Inn signs in other places, a lot of them are, like, on the second floor. They're not blazing on the top of a building. If you look at other hotels in the Chapel Hill area, they have very discreet signs. I'm feeling like maybe we don't need to change everything for.
Well, they also wouldn't have.
Well, okay.
Wouldn't be able to have the retail signs.
Let's hear from Laura, and then let's wrap this topic up.
Thanks, Tina.
First of all, I'd like to say I actually agree with a lot of the advisory board recommendations. I think the sign ordinance clearly does need a bit of some tweaking, if not an overhaul, given projects like ours and others that might be following later. Take aside the whole issue of the hotel, the big sign at the top of the wall for a minute, it doesn't address the needs of everything else. We have two street frontages of our retail space. We only get credit for signage allocation based on one of the street frontages because Main Street is the only public street, and we have a private street as well. We also have an entrance to the parking deck and the hotel that are off the road. There's no way to get, for example, we don't have permission right now, or we'd have to use some of that limited square footage allocation to put a sign, say, out at Boyd and Main to direct people to go into the parking deck there so they're not driving into the main part of downtown and clogging things up. So the sign ordinance needs some tweaking, and I think if you do adopt this ordinance, I also agree that some guidelines would be very helpful. They wouldn't just be helpful for whatever review board is looking at any sign proposal. It would also be helpful for the applicant because we're kind of flying blind. We really don't know, have any guidelines to work with as far as what is acceptable for the town or what's not. To Jackie's point, I think it was Jackie's point, that if nothing happens, we're limited to the second floor, et cetera. That's actually not the case. There's currently no restriction in Carver about the second floor, and in theory, we could, under the current sign ordinance, take all of our square footage and put it on a big sign at the top of the hotel building now. We certainly don't want to do that. We want our retailer to have signs. But currently, even with the existing ordinance, I don't think it really fits completely your needs as well. We do have, obviously, some urgency. Unfortunately, at this point, we are under construction. As you all know, we're opening in late April is when the building is scheduled to open. So we need to have some certainty. So I apologize for this being kind of have that urgent request, but would hope that you can, if you can't act on, don't feel comfortable acting on this ordinance tonight, that you at least get some process in motion so that we don't postpone any further what is now scheduled to be a late September public hearing and potential vote on our sign plans. It's really already later than we'd like it to be, so we wouldn't like that to slip any further. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's some confusion about what our current signage would allow and in comparison to this. And I think one of the things that this this draft ordinance does is it gives us some some measure of flexibility and review when a master plan comes before us. And I like what Dan had to say before as a way of addressing this immediate concern, because I think that that's what we need to do.
I'm fine with that.
Okay. Let me just add that several of us recall when we adopted the architectural guidelines, and that was when I first came on the board, and when Randy first came on, but that was a pretty involved process that took a while. So, you know, if we're contemplating something similar for the sign standards, you know, it could easily take at least a couple of rounds of public hearings mm-hmm. to get through. And, you know, we're talking about aesthetics potentially, where there are so many opinions in Carborough. And anyway, so I'm not. I think we should do that, but I still don't see that we need to hold this up, and that this hotel is something we've been committed to as well as Main Street Partners.
All right. So I take that as a motion, maybe. I'm coming to you in 1 second.
Well, I don't want to shut off conversation by making a motion prematurely.
Well, I don't know that it will shut off conversation. Okay. I think it might sharpen the focus
of
the conversation.
Well, I will move the resolution of consistency then.
Okay. Sammy.
I kind of see this as an opportunity for us to really think about all the issues involved with such an ordinance. I definitely agree with the various boards and the need for some guidance, and having no guidance, I would recommend to the applicant that you consider our current ordinance as guidance. There's a spirit involved in what's involved there, and for the board to really, as we think about these new buildings, how is it that the spirit of the current ordinance will also be reflected in whatever we come up with later. But I think we do need some standards, both for future applicants and for the various boards to compare what's being proposed. I certainly don't want us to, give more, I don't know. I just want to learn what the issues are. Like, for example, Carmel Mall has a bunch of internal stores that don't necessarily have signage on the road. So how is this project compared to that? And so for the applicant, be forewarned. Like, those are the kinds of things I'm going to be thinking about. You may not get what you're hoping for. I'm going to be thinking about other current situations that may not have the full advantage that you're thinking you should have.
Lydia.
We'll wait a second yet.
We're waiting for a second.
Yeah, I'll second. And I'm just going to say that, it's clear this is going to be a lengthy kind of look discussion and kind of an overhaul over a few month period to kind of work out how best to deal with future developments that don't fit into what we have right now by virtue of having, you know, street frontage. So I don't want the planning board and the appearance commission and the other folks to have weighed in to think we're not, you know, considering what they have to say, because it's very helpful and it'll inform where we go with this. But at the same time, I recognize, as everyone here does, I think that we've got to give the hotel East Main what they need in order to move forward, and that would be my suggestion to move forward with this. But I also, you haven't gotten to the second motion yet, but I'm assuming we'll go with what staff recommends.
So maybe we need to clarify that, you know, should this ordinance pass, that the Main Street property, the hotel, would still have to come before us to have their signage approved.
This does not sort of throw the door wide open. To them having Hampton Inn blazed at the top of the building.
That's where the appearance comes.
Exactly.
Right. Well,
we need still narrative.
Well, let me hear. Let me hear. Staff.
It's part of the public hearing process. So it would still go to the advisory boards for comments. Mm-hmm.
But then who makes the ultimate decision?
And then you would make the ultimate decision, but
exactly.
You would get their feedback.
We would make the ultimate decision.
Would somebody
not
mind?
On the plan, but not on the individual sign.
On the plan, but this
on their master
plan.
Sign
on
plan.
The master plan, but not on the individual.
But so, for example, questions like, is it going to say Hampton Inn or whatever high up on the building? Is that a part of the master plan, or is that a detail that's decided by the?
Excuse me for stepping in front of Tina. I don't mean to. I won't stay here long in front of her. But just to clarify, they potentially could, the way the ordinance is written right now, they could come in tomorrow with a sign permit application for that Hampton Inn sign at the top of the building. And we have little to no authority to not approve it as long as it meets the ordinance as the ordinance is currently written. We send it to the Appearance Commission. The Appearance Commission can recommend changes and hopefully work with a willing applicant to make changes. But at the end of the day, if it meets the ordinance, it's kind of a by right thing and it has to be approved. The result, though, if they did come in tomorrow, is they would have very little signed budget left. As the ordinance is currently written.
So if but, to clarify, okay, but they so, could. But here's my question: is so after this is changed, so after if we adopt this tonight, is the same thing still true?
It is true that if you adopt this tonight, it would afford them the opportunity to apply for this CUP master sign plan, but they would not be obligated to apply for a master sign plan. They could come in and.
So this
apply
doesn't really open. I mean, this doesn't particularly open the door to them. Doing anything by right. I mean, there are things they have a right to do, but they already have that right under the existing ordinance.
They do, and that right would remain. It's just that they would have very little signed budget left if they were to do that.
It's an alternative option.
Marty, explain what you mean by signed budget.
Yes, sorry. That's I'm using that term. Anyway, what I mean by that is, and I don't know the exact numbers here, but let's say they have, based on the amount of street frontage, the way the ordinance is currently written, they get this is not the number, but 500 square feet of signage for the project. And let's say the Hampton Inn sign took up 400 square feet of that. They would only have 100 left for all the remaining storefronts in the site or on the site. So by sign budget, I mean just an overall allocation of how much signage they can have. And that Hampton Inn sign, any way you look at it, would take up a big chunk of it.
They have something like 8 to 10 storefronts in the hotel building alone. Is that right?
Yeah, or 6 to 8. Is it 6 to 8?
Up to 9.
Or up to 9. Okay, up to 9.
Up to 9. So I mean, anyway, realistically, those businesses are going to want to have some kind of sign. But anyway.
So, really clearly, okay, and simply, if we pass this tonight, what is the net effect for this project? And for the community, if we pass this tonight.
Well, I'll defer to Tina if she needs to clarify something I say, but the only point I'm really trying to make is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the passing of this amendment tonight would not obligate them to come in and file a CUP master sign plan. It's very clear to me that that is their desire, and I have no reason to think they wouldn't move forward with that. But that's really the only point I'm making.
Okay. So.
And what by right? What by right do they have to? What rights do they have under that master sign plan CUP, whatever it was, string of nouns that you put together? what new rights would they have under this ordinance?
They would have the right to apply. Whether the board would be obligated to approve it, I would perhaps defer to Mr. Hornick. It would be, we've been considering that it would be a minor modification with a public hearing, and generally speaking, unless you respond differently, that the board has broad authority to approve or deny something that's considered a minor modification. That's a really
this
wrong
doesn't
way of
move,
saying
like,
you wouldn't have to approve.
Right, but like hypothetically, you threw this number out there, just like a kind of hypothetical picked out of the air. This doesn't change from 500 to 510 square feet the amount of signage they can get in any way.
Only if the board ultimately approves.
So it gives us the latitude to consider giving them some more.
Which it doesn't.
Okay,
have
thank
now.
You. Jackie, I apologize. I totally jumped in on your question,
that's
but
all right.
I was trying to really get down to make sure we really get it.
I know, just really simple that
all
we
right.
can, and so. We would not be cutting out the Appearance Commission. The Appearance Commission would still be in a strong advisory capacity with this.
And
correct?
This board would make the final
That's
call.
Right.
And this board would make real simple.
On the plan.
On the master plan.
On the master plan.
If we approve one of those plans, then later on
the
individual ones under that plan would go just them.
But that would include things like, the master plan would include things like big signs on the top of the building, correct?
Yes. If they want it there under in the context of a master sign plan, then yes. I think the short answer is yes. I won't go on and complicate it.
They know they're not getting a sign on top of the building.
All right, and Mr. Attorney, we're not sort of accidentally throwing the door open to giving them some right to have a sign at the top of the building.
No, because I mean they come before you with a master plan.
Right.
Okay. Gives you some opportunity to work with them,
okay,
to tweak it and control.
Okay.
Some controls anyway.
All right. So it's been moved and seconded for the resolution of consistency. All those in favor of the resolution of consistency signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Is there a motion for the ordinance?
Well, let me clarify with Tina.
Right.
You said it was the 271B that we would strike to ensure that it continues to go to the Appearance Commission. Did I understand that correctly?
It's at the very bottom of Attachment B, and I'm sorry, there's a little sticky note, Attachment B2, that was supposed to be at the top of the page that migrated, so just disregard that. But it's number 3 towards the very bottom. It's the third to the last item that says...
On what page?
Attachment B. Attachment B at the
D
very bottom.
Three. It's one sentence.
It's D
as in dog 3.
Yeah.
Dog 3.
Right. It says signs erected in a manner that is consistent, it's supposed to say, with the master sign plan approved in accordance with this section, do not require the issuance of a sign.
I'm sorry, I still don't know what you're looking at.
Attachment B.
Page D3?
B.
It's B.
B.
Ordinance. It's right here. This.
Oh, so we just, okay.
That just migrated.
So we could.
You could strike that.
So strike that entire number 3 there.
By striking it, does that then say that it goes to the Appearance Commission? What that would mean was that after you all approve their master sign, that subsequent signs, you know, tenant renewals and so forth, would have to go to the Appearance Commission and follow the standard sign permit process that we have now.
Okay, so I will move Attachment B, striking that number 3 that Tina just indicated.
All right, is there a second?
Second.
It's been seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Is there anything at this point in terms of next steps regarding overall sign discussion that we want to ask staff to look into? Because we talked about having further guidance. Do we want to ask staff?
We want a proposal for a process for reviewing the sign ordinance and standards.
In the fall? Can we do that? I'd like to do that. Thank you.
A proposal in the fall,
mm-hmm.
Not a review in the fall.
Are you for a process and
yes.
Or standards, too? I mean, there's...
Well, wait.
Well, the process would lead to
standards. Include the
same. Right.
Yeah.
That goes to the same.
There's also a second resolution.
Don't read
C.
It. Yeah. Oh, that's C.
That's resolution C.
Okay.
Yeah. Set a public hearing for September the 25th.
Well, I'll move attachment C then.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
But in addition to that, I'd like staff to come back with us and come back to us and give us a report on how we can proceed with having more guidance on signage.
Now there is
with respect to the master planning.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Just to be clear, there is in the ordinance, although it's within the body of the paragraph, there are a number of criteria that the attorney has laid out. Mm-hmm. So in theory, the staff could be very clear in the staff report to reflect those as kind of a study aid, if you will.
That'd be helpful.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Our next item, I think it's number 4, is a public hearing of land use ordinance text amendment relating to payments in lieu of affordable housing.
Tina. This item is, will provide you flexibility when you consider item C1 below. They are interrelated.
Okay.
all ready. This next item is a request to consider a zoning text amendment related to affordable housing. And there are a number of attachments with this, and a lot of them are resolutions. So if you'll bear with me, I'd just like to kind of go over those real quick and make sure that we're all in sync. Attachment A is consistency resolutions, which are required for text amendments. B is a revised draft ordinance that was put on your place this evening, just to make sure that, and it's dated today, so it's dated June 26th. Attachment C is a land use ordinance text amendment request from the Community Home Trust, and I believe there's a representative here if you'd like to hear from them later. D is a memo from the Community Home Trust. Attachment E is the relevant sections of the land use ordinance, the sections that we're talking about amending. Attachment F is a resolution to set an affordable housing payment in lieu fee. There's a blank there to add this to the miscellaneous fees and charges schedule. And attachment G is a resolution granting a waiver to the Community Home Trust for the cost of the application fee for the text amendment. And finally, attachment H are the comments from advisory boards and Orange County.
So are the action items A, B, C, E, and G? Did I catch that correctly?
Let me show that real quick. That sounds right.
Or maybe it's ABC, no, ABC, F, and G. And I have a question about the modified ordinance that was at our place. If I'm reading it correctly, the way that's written allows us to use the proposal that was originally in our packet or the alternative proposal that I had made, or really any other system, as long as we identify the factors that we consider relevant in establishing the bid. Is that correct?
Pretty much. I was going to touch on that in a minute, but
okay,
yeah, pretty much.
Uh-huh.
Real quick, in terms of our overview background, in February, the town received a memo from Community Home Trust. This is attachment D, requesting that the town amend the land use ordinance to assist with the sale of some of the designated affordable townhomes in the Ballantyne subdivision. The request included a couple of different parts. The first part was amending the definition of an affordable housing unit. This is outlined in section 15-182.4. This was what we addressed in March when we looked at allowing a percentage of affordable housing units to be sold to a higher buyer, a higher amount. Part two was a request to amend the way that the town determines the amount for the affordable housing payment in lieu fee, and that's what we're going to talk about this evening. The current payment in lieu option is provided for in section 15-54.1, and I've outlined right here the specific section which talks about a mechanism whereby we determine kind of an average subsidy for the past year, and we put that into place, and that becomes the in lieu of fee amount. The proposed amendment, if you go ahead and adopt it, would simply replace this section altogether and would instead create a different mechanism to establish this fee, and it would be placed annually as part of the town's miscellaneous fees and charges schedule. And really the reasoning behind this is that the Community Home Trust has come to staff and has said that this system that we have right now just isn't working. As times have changed in the economy and the housing market, that the fee that was generated, the number that was generated, was really too high to be usable. And so based on that thought, the town attorney put together what he thought was a reasonable way of looking at this, which was essentially taking the costs to create a unit, to build a unit, the cost to construct the unit, the land costs, any other associated costs, and to subtract from that the amount that you could sell the unit for. And we found that it was internally confusing, and we found that we weren't I'm not really explaining this very well, but we found that it just wasn't really working even from an in-house approach. And as we went, we had to look for the developers to provide us with the fees, and it was difficult to get enough to provide a good sample of data to really come up with a good number. So based on further consideration, staff has prepared this revised ordinance, which is at your place, and it essentially includes three parts to it. Part I still uses the same calculation that I've just described. Part two, or the double I's, offers an opportunity for the board to kind of look at this in terms of, is the fee getting to such a point where it's going to be the automatic default? You know, are we really getting our goal of getting an affordable housing unit, or are people just automatically doing the in lieu of fee because it's easier? And then finally, item three offers you an opportunity to look at other factors that have changed, and I think the market is a good example of that, so that we don't have to come back and do a text amendment. If the market shifts a little bit, it gives you an opportunity to have a little more flexibility in how you set the fee. this was, in terms of our standard procedural notes that we just covered, again, a text amendment is legislative, so you have to do the consistency statement, and you have to hold a public hearing. We have a number of provisions in the Vision 2020 that speak to affordable housing. These are the two that seemed most relevant. I think the Planning Board struggled with the first one a little bit and felt that provision 6.17 certainly did apply. I think they still have some concerns about how we handle affordable housing. I think they're interested in looking at the whole ball of wax, and so they had a little bit of concern with 6.11. In terms of our recommendations, Orange County had found no inconsistency. Again, the Planning Board really struggled with this whole issue, and so while they recognize the interest of Community Home Trust, again, trying to resolve a specific situation, they really had difficulty kind of having a unanimous vote on this, and so their one unanimous vote really was to encourage you all to look at the whole affordable housing program, something which they would like to be a part of. Finally, the attachments that are provided for you, you have the attachment for resolution. We would hope that you would consider adopting the amendment, which would allow you a way to calculate this new fee.
All right. We have Bethany Cheney signed up to speak. Bethany, if you would come up.
Hi, I'm Bethany Cheney. I'm a member of the Planning Committee, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Planning Committee tonight, as John Colleen, our chair, is not here to do so. I wanted to make it clear why the Planning Board could not come to a consensus vote on adopting the recommended changes to the LUO. We had a really rich discussion about the merits and the deficits or deficiencies of setting a calculation for a fee that isn't pegged to quantifiable or qualitative goals that the town has deliberately set around affordable housing, and therefore how to use the fee ultimately to advance those goals. The fee doesn't seem to be relevant to what our objectives are, and we'd like to see more relevance. Second, we had a discussion about whether the fee and the calculation that we saw at the Planning Board meeting actually took into consideration the true opportunity costs that the town faces when an affordable unit is not built, the opportunity costs that organizations like CHT face when that unit is also not built, and therefore the opportunity costs their clients face. And then the opportunity cost the developer is weighing in deciding whether or not to build that unit. And until those opportunity costs come a little bit closer, then the developer is likely never going to want to build an actual unit, but instead will pay the fee. And in fact, my understanding is that that is exactly what is happening now. And it's monetary forces, not just non-monetary forces, that are making that calculation work really more for the benefit of the developer rather than the town if our objective is to see more units in the ground. So we discussed that, and we weren't sure this calculation was fair. And finally, we discussed whether coming to this point where we're faced with discussing a payment in lieu at the 11th hour in order to solve a problem for a developer and its partner nonprofit agency is really the best way to set policy. And so two members of the board really felt like it was our responsibility to instead recommend that this change not be made and instead that the Board of Aldermen commit to a process to review affordable housing policy, the goals surrounding policy, therefore what the fee needs to be in order to advance those goals, and whether the toolkit that we have as a town is really aligned with what we need as a town, and if not, how do we fix that? There may not be one single solution, and there is certainly no solution for fixing the affordable housing problem that we have, but we can expand the toolkit, and we can make it easier for organizations like CHT to work with private developers and get their objectives met as well. So that was the dissension, that we felt like this was bad policy to change the fee now, set it for a year just to solve a problem if, in fact, there was no other process in place to review the entire structure in which we're looking at affordable housing in town.
Was there anybody else who came to speak on this matter?
I'd like to hear Robert's response to the planning board's concerns.
Robert, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Robert Dowling, Executive Director of Community Home Trust, and I spoke to the planning board last week, and I pretty much agree with much of what Bethany just said. I believe that the town should ideally take a comprehensive look at the entire inclusionary housing ordinance and do a rewrite. I think I've been saying that for a while. In the absence of our ability to get to that, this made it to the last meeting, thanks to Trish, because of one specific development, the Ballantyne development, and the guys from Ballantyne here have a situation where there's a, I think it's a win-win for the town and for them if they don't build two affordable units and they give the town a payment in lieu. And I think it's a win-win because they've already built 8 townhomes out there. They got CO'd, I think, last week. And we have contracts on 2 of them. We have 6 that we don't have contracts on. And we're struggling a little bit to sell the units. We have some interest in a couple of units. But there is no bus transportation out there. And that's the biggest negative for our population of buyers. And we need approximately $30,000 of subsidy for each of those units in order to sell them. And so 2 units, $60,000 of subsidy, that is hard to come by these days. If a payment in lieu could be made to the town, if that's reasonable, according to the alderman and based on your discussion this evening, the town would have some money to use for whatever your priorities are in the affordable housing world. And the developer wouldn't have to build this hybrid building as 4 units in one building and 2 are market rate and 2 are affordable. And the market rates typically have garages and they're larger, and the affordables don't have garages and they're smaller, and it's going to be a kind of an odd duck building. And so I think it works for the developer, I think it works for the town, and I think it works for us. And so although I agree with Bethany that we ideally don't want to do this on sort of a ad hoc basis. The developer, they can speak to their timing, but they finished their first block of market rate townhomes that are out there and they're built. And the second block was intended to be built in fall, and so that's why I asked Trish if we could get to this before you all went on break. Did I answer your questions?
I just wanted to respond to Bethany and the planning board further. Thanks for your work on this and comments, and it's good timing because some of us met with town staff and Robert Dowling on Friday and are going to later tonight propose that a committee be developed from this board, including town staff, Robert, and some discussion with developers about an overhaul related to our affordable housing policy. And our hope is that we will come up with a plan that includes an affordable housing option to build that, a payment in lieu option, or size limited. And we're hoping, if we can do this legally, that one of those things will be a requirement of the developer. So it's an ordinance instead of our goal or policy. So we are going to just briefly talk about that later this evening. And definitely heard what you all said about what we need to do.
Robert, one of the issues here is that the funds from the federal and state are drying up, and that these used to be supplemental to the subsidy that essentially the developer provided. So the question I think that is significant, in part one of the questions from the planning board, is to what extent is this payment in lieu representative of what the developer would have been providing as a match when we did have those funds?
In your ordinance, the current ordinance for affordable housing, if the developer opts to do the 15% affordable units rather than the 25% size restricted, they are required to provide the units that are that need to be priced affordably to a family at 80% of median. That's in the ordinance. Appropriately sized family. So one-bedroom condo would be affordable to a one-person household. So a three-bedroom house would be to a three-person household. The Ballantyne development was approved under the old ordinance, and the prices were actually a little higher than that. We're buying a two-bedroom unit for $120,000, a three-bedroom unit for $130,000. So we're having to bring in more subsidy for Ballantyne than we ordinarily would have to bring in under the current ordinance. And I hope I didn't lose you all with this.
I'm with you so far.
I know you are, Mr. Mayor. So this is the only time this is going to happen, because they got approval under the old ordinance, which you may remember required that the homes be priced at a certain level, but they could be sold to anyone. They could be sold to an investor. They didn't have to be lived in by a first-time home buyer. They could be rented out. So that's the old ordinance, and they got approval just as it was changing last time, which was in 07. So we worked out an accommodation. The board, Ballantyne, ourselves, we worked out this sort of compromise. We have to get about $30,000 of subsidy for each one of their units. Under the new ordinance, the current ordinance, they have to bring it in at affordable 80%, and we are bringing it down by maybe 65%. That's less subsidy, Sammy, because the developer's taking a bigger hit in the current ordinance. They're providing more of the subsidy, and the public is providing less of the subsidy in the current ordinance. I can't just give you a figure.
Right. I guess the question is, if we did have the money, then what would the developer, their match represent? You know, because that's the idea is that because we can't play with them, then they can still play with us. And, you know, we can put those funds aside and accumulate the funds so we can later play.
Part of the answer to how much they would otherwise essentially have put forward in the form of the real estate, what that costs them to put that forward, part of the answer depends on your success in marketing the real estate, does it not?
Yes, it does.
So, I mean, it really is impossible to say, because what you don't know is whether you're simply going to completely fail to sell the last two units and have those go back to the developer in X period of time, whatever, I forget what the period of time is.
It's 1 year.
In 1 year. So I guess the point being that, like, well, if they're successfully sold as affordable housing, it may cost them, you know, X tens of thousands of dollars. But if they never get sold and the units revert back to them, right, it may still cost them something, but it'll be a very different number. So it's difficult to say.
And I think that's a key component here. And I hate to have to say this to you because it sort of doesn't reflect well on us, but we don't always sell all these units as quickly as we would like to sell them or as quickly as people think we should be able to sell them. Right. And I don't have a good answer as to why we don't. As I said, there's no bus service out at Ballantyne. I think Ballantyne is an attractive community. I think these townhomes that they build for us are attractive. And with the subsidy we're bringing in, they are well-priced. You can buy a two-bedroom unit out there for $88,000. It's affordable, and they're nice. If we had them buyers lined up so that when they got those COs, we just knocked them down and closed them, I would say we may not want a payment in lieu. There's demand for the housing. But when we're struggling to sell the units, I can't stand up here and say to you there's overwhelming demand for the housing.
So given all those complicating factors, how does one know what's an appropriate payment in lieu?
That's a tricky one, Sammy. It's really tricky. And I've been giving it some thought, and Dan has spurred my thinking, and it's really hard. Theoretically, philosophically, what I think is that it should be a win-win. I said to you all last week that we want developers to be successful. And they're all struggling right now. Some are failing. Some have gone away. Some local developers are no longer even doing any business anymore. We want them to be successful. We don't want them to fail. But we want it to be successful for the town as well. So it's a balancing act. If they were to offer $5,000 per unit, I would recommend that you not accept that. It's not worth taking $5,000 a unit. So it's currently about $75,000 or $80,000. That's too much, and $5,000 is too little. It's really hard for me to know what the right number is.
So if I could jump in here for a second, you know, brainstorming about this, I mean, the difficulty in my experience with the affordable housing development work I've done, which is quite a bit different model from the work that Robert does, that you know, figures like $50,000 are not, you know, that's not an uncommon amount of subsidy at this point to go into a dwelling unit, or even 75 is not necessarily that uncommon once you take into account various sources of subsidy. No one party ever really puts in that much. But so on the one hand, I sort of think, like, well, if we're missing out on an affordable dwelling unit at any particular development, that it feels like what we'll need instead is, you know, dollar figures that are in, you know, they're pretty substantial. And the other point I wanted to make is I think one of the other reasons that it's important to accept payments in lieu, at least sometimes, is that you run into these situations from time to time where somebody in town is living on Social Security and in a house that they've lived in for 30 or 40 years, and they simply don't have the money or the physical abilities to keep up that house. And the most effective thing that you can do, you know, the most cost-effective way to keep the person nicely housed is to simply help them replace their roof. And these funds, you know, provide those kind of opportunities. And there are some federal programs for that purpose. But unfortunately, under the terms of the federal programs, typically, if once you make any repair, you have to make every repair. And so you somebody comes in asking you for a new roof, and before you know it, you're replumbing their house and rewiring their house and doing everything else to their house because the federal rules come with so many strings attached. And I could point out a half dozen other federal rules, by the way, that cause, you know, there are good reasons for the rules, but they cause practical problems on the ground. Local funding sources like this have a lot fewer strings attached, and it allows us some additional flexibility, both the nonprofit developer and the town government.
Good point.
Final thing I'll add is that, again, from experience, what happens is when somebody comes in asking for existing owner-occupied repairs is that they come in with $5,000 to $10,000 worth of problems, maybe $15,000, but that once you do a full assessment of their house, that it's often closer to $50,000. So, again, that maybe gives a sense of the scale of what the need is for any one individual unit, from my perspective.
So, Mark, from your perspective as someone who's been a professional in the area, what was your reaction to the proposal I sent around this morning, and it's our place for a mechanism for coming up with the payment amount?
I'll get back to you.
Okay.
While the mayor's reading that, there's one thing I'd like to point out that I think is important in any new ordinance that the board approve is that the payment in lieu should be at the discretion of the Board of Aldermen. The developer can propose, we'll do 15 units and two payments in lieu. And the Board of Aldermen are the ones who get to decide whether that's acceptable. So it's not an, in my view, it should not be an automatic. It shouldn't be at the discretion of the developer.
Mm-hmm. Robert, did you read Dan's proposal?
I did.
And?
I like the simplicity of it.
Yeah.
As I mentioned to Dan, there's not a direct connection between a developer, what a developer is doing on the ground, and the number. But it's a number that's easily arrived at, mm-hmm. easy to understand, and it's kind of in the ballpark of, I think, probably where it should be.
Right.
Dan, of course, the people at home don't know what we're talking about.
32-ish.
Dan, I have a question about your method. Are you mm-hmm. suggesting that it be incorporated into the ordinance, or are you suggesting it be the mechanism that the ordinance uses then to enforce the purpose of the ordinance?
Right. Well, I think maybe Bob could speak to this, but he's written the ordinance such as that we adopt the ordinance and then use this mechanism if we choose to establish. So I think we would probably reference it in our item F, our resolution setting the payment in lieu for the coming year is where we would reference that, you know, that we're using this methodology.
Right. So this ordinance is dated June 26th. In other words, that incorporates
it allows this.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, Robert, it sounds like you're in agreement. This isn't. That's what ultimately my questions were about. This number, how does that compare relative to what a developer currently provides when they actually provide a physical affordable unit? It sounds like you're in agreement. 32,000 is reasonable.
I think that's definitely in the ballpark, Sammy. I think it depends on. All developments are different. There are downtown condo developments that have been approved in Carver where I think the board accepted payments in lieu for some of those.
Mm-hmm.
The Butler comes to mind. It may never get built.
Like one or something.
Mm-hmm. But there's different construction costs for a condominium, particularly if there's structured parking, than there is for a subdivision.
Right.
And so it's really hard to compare. In this one, I point this out to the planning board. For Ballantyne, I know the ordinance is not specific to Ballantyne. We're dealing with this sort of on an ad hoc basis because of Ballantyne. But Ballantyne was approved in 07. And it was in 2011 or 2012 even where I raised the prospect of let's not do 17 homes. And I ran that by the Ballantyne guys and I ran it by the board and gave you my reasons. And both of you were amenable to listening to that. But the thing that's different about Ballantyne is their footprint is set. They can't change what they've got approval to build. And in most instances, you'll be doing this at the outset. You'll be doing this when the developer comes to you.
Not on the back end.
And they have flexibility now to say, okay, we're going to be building these 3,000 square foot houses instead of an affordable house, and therefore I have this much, you have more margin in a large house, which is going to cost more. They've got this little footprint on which there's supposed to be two two affordables and two market rate, and they can't change that. And so their ability to take in high price and take in margin to make the payment is restricted.
All right. Is there any way we can be done by 10 o'clock?
I just want to make a quick...
So is that a no?
No.
Sorry, I'm just teasing. Go ahead.
I just want to say that, you know, although we received this late today, I mean, you know, with my work schedule this week, I read Dan's proposal late this afternoon.
Me too.
I want to thank Dan for his work on this. It's...
And Anita. Don't forget Anita.
And Anita, I saw. You thanked her in the document, which is great. What I like best about it is that it breathes with the market, and I like that. I think that's one of the things that I think was missing before, and it really, that gets to something more that we would like to see reflected. So I really appreciate the elegance of capturing that because, I think that's a piece that we're sorely missing. So thank you.
Maybe just for the benefit of the public, could you just, what do you mean by breathe with the market, though?
Looking at the median, as soon as I read that piece, I felt, wow, that's what's missing because when you look at the median as opposed to the average and you're looking at, for example, the example that was given, for years 2009, 2010, 2011, if you look at the median, it's looking at those 3 years. And if you, look at the average, it was way higher. Additionally, when you look at the median after each year, the way you've got this set up, then the next year, for example, the next year would be 2010, 2011, 2012, and that's where that breathing with the market comes in, which I think
rolling average.
Exactly, and that expresses something that was really missing. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.
So,
yes, I'll move the resolution of consistency.
Second. Moves the resolution of consistency. Seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the amendment passes unanimously.
Move the draft ordinance at our place.
Thanks, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Okay.
Second.
Been moved and seconded for the draft ordinance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right.
Move the land use ordinance request, attachment C.
That's C.
Is that in the next agenda item?
That's the next agenda item.
It is?
Mr. Attorney...
that's the request. Okay, you're right.
Yeah. Procedurally...
Attachment F will be your next consideration.
F.
Thanks, my error.
Okay.
So,
it is a... it's not a public hearing.
Okay, so moving attachment F?
Mm-hmm.
I'll second that.
Let's add the stipulation that we are using the method of 10% of the average of closed housing sales for the last 3 years, as reported in the MLS.
Well, you know, for the people at home, it might be nice that we talk about what the agenda item is and what we're voting on.
Haven't we been doing that for half an hour?
Well, we're not.
We're not putting in numbers.
Okay, yeah. So what that adds up to for this year is $37,243.
No,
$31,800. Well, that's the median.
Right, we're using the median.
Yeah. Well, you just said the average.
No, it's the average of the median.
Average of the median.
Yes.
Average
sorry.
Of the median, right.
Sorry, I was less than clear.
Thank you. All right, $31,833 is the figure.
Right, and if the resolution recognizes the use of that methodology so that can be retained as a precedent next year.
And so it notes here that is about that figure, that's setting the figure about $2,000 higher than what MI had offered at one point earlier this year.
Yes.
Right, that's right.
Okay. So
just for
and that includes review each year.
Well, it would change. The number would change each year.
Exactly.
I'm just saying that's what the number would be.
Right, it would be on the schedule, like any other fee.
Okay, so
that was moved in a second.
That's F. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Matter passes unanimously. All right.
Move resolution attachment J.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded for attachment G. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Matter passes unanimously. All right. A request for minor modification of Ballantyne Architecturally Integrated Subdivision and Conditional Use Permit related to affordable housing. You think you can do this in three sentences, Mark?
I can, yes, as long as that doesn't count. upon adoption of the last agenda item, we have a minor modification in front of you for the Ballantyne project. The fee for the two units would be, if I have this correct, $31,833 apiece. Mm-hmm. And the developer is here and perhaps may wish to comment on their if they find that acceptable. We have not spoken. I spoke briefly with Jeremy by phone earlier today, so he had some sense, I believe, of where I'm exceeding my three sentences now.
You're up to like five now, Martin.
I should have just stopped by saying they may wish to comment on that.
All right. Thanks, Marty. Do you guys have something you want to say briefly?
I think I've got a couple of things to say, but I'm not quite sure what specifically I'm being asked to address up there.
Well, what's proposed here? I mean, what the board has done is adopted $31,833 as the dollar figure. So is that an acceptable?
That won't work for me right now. It's too high.
Uh-huh.
And let me explain to you why. And I think Robert was very clear about it. We have townhouses that we've built. We have eight of them, market-driven towns. And we work very difficult and diligently, with difficulty, but with diligence, to assign market value to everything we build. The market value in February, when I penned this letter, we had just come off our biggest sales month of the last 6 months. The market was hot. We put the townhouses into construction, underway. Felt very comfortable. Market has deteriorated since then. I have all eight townhouses sitting that are market-driven. They all have two-car garages. They're all 1,900 square feet. They're all priced to market at $150 a retail foot, which is what MLS had at the time selling in January and February. We've reduced them by $20,000 a unit. They're now priced at about $132 a foot. We think that's closer to market. The four units that we have in a hybrid building, so that sort of gives you a sense of where the market is. Market's very, very tough, very challenging. The four units we have are smaller. They're 1,300 square feet. They're captive to a footprint that doesn't allow a garage. And I have two units that are market-driven next to two units that are affordable. When I run all of my math, and all of the financial calculations, we fully agreed through my predecessor to go ahead and build these 17 units and accept a hybrid building. I came before you 5 years ago, my first job here in Raleigh, to get your approval for the CUP, and you did so. And my predecessors had arranged and negotiated all of that before me. If you think about having four units, two of which will sell at $120,000 a piece, adjacent to market units that look the same, feel the same, touch the same, have the same square footage and no garage, while competing with units up the street that are bigger and considerably better apportioned. My number, for what I think is fair for this unique circumstance, is closer to $22,000 to $23,000 per unit, not $32,000. I don't have the ability to come up that high.
So you'd rather build two more units than pay that?
I don't know that I'd rather. I mean, you know, part of this discussion came up because
I don't rather continuing past 10 o'clock. But I mean,
understand.
You know,
okay.
I mean,
here's you know, we
we're down to quibbling about a pretty small amount of money here.
Yeah,
some point.
it's about $18,000 to $20,000. And it's a lot of money for me. I can't in justice say that I can accede to that. I will tell you that part of what drove this whole process was that there wasn't money to get affordable units sold. So,
will there be even less money to get affordable units sold if you're not going to work with us on this? So I'm getting ready to go home based on what you're telling me.
Are you withdrawing your request?
I don't know if withdrawing it is the right word. Perhaps we could table it and we could have another discussion. It's been a long night for everyone. I've not seen this document before. I think $32,000 per unit is higher than what the market will bear. I think it's unreasonable. And I personally think it puts our company in a bad spot.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
Second.
Is there a second for the motion?
We'll take 5 seconds.
Well, no, we have another matter.
There's another matter.
Is there another matter?
Yeah, Michelle and I want to talk about our committee. Mark didn't read
it. I guess I'm not up to date on my emails. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Surprise.
Well, I said it earlier when I was
okay.
To
well, all right.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a motion then on this agenda item? Because I'm not aware of a motion I could vote for at this point.
So there's no motion on this agenda, which means we move on to the next.
Okay. So let's move on to your email.
So I emailed earlier. I mentioned earlier tonight to Bethany, or in response to Bethany, that Dan and I and town staff and Robert met the other day, and we'd like the board to approve us having an affordable housing committee that starts to meet in August and meets until December, and then comes back with a recommendation for a change in the ordinance. Dan can jump in here, but including size limited payment in lieu.
Yes, I will jump in by seconding.
And affordable housing.
And Michelle and I will be on that, would like to be on that committee.
Yeah.
And depending anyone else wanting to be on.
I would like to offer a friendly amendment. I would like to see that someone from the planning board be liaison to that group, since they're very much interested and invested.
Well, I think our intention is, as we develop process, that we're going to reach out to whatever parties
there'll be
engaged.
Of
right.
Things
but
like
I
that.
Think it would, because of the work that they've been doing,
to have
them, involved, you know, from the beginning would expedite, you know, the conversation, and so that they wouldn't be behind, they would be part of the most progressive conversation in it.
Yeah, well, we would certainly want to avail ourselves of that perspective.
If no one else is interested, I'd like to be on that committee.
All right. Well, what we probably need to do, what we probably would need then is a, I guess we need to have a resolution that'll. Well, do you want to have a resolution that kind of that lays this out a little more specifically?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or
right. I mean, this is similar to how we created our Owasso subcommittee, just mm-hmm. like something throughout.
I would like.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you. Okay. Which way you want to go?
Okay.
That's all.
No, let's just go.
I'd like to move that Sammy and Dan and Michelle form an affordable housing committee,
okay,
and use their best insights, knowledge, and the resources of the town and the town's advisory board to come up with a recommendation to come to this board in December.
Thank you.
Is that a second?
Second. Yeah. Thanks, Jackie.
Right.
Well done.
Some gratitude.
Okay. And this is sort of for an overall.
Well,
kind of look at affordable housing strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Matter passes.
Have at it, kids.
Is there a motion?
Wait. There's Randy's resolution.
We did it already.
Sammy's got the additions.
I just have a couple of additions. Really quickly, I would like to add last whereas, which says there have been 17 non-transparent settlement agreements between Duke, Progress Energy, and customer groups, which may be subject to open records laws. And then at the end, there are four sections. One which reads, we ask that the NC Attorney General review whether merger settlement agreements between the utilities and customer groups do not violate NC open records laws. And finally, add to the last section of Randy's that we also forward this to the Attorney General.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thanks, Randy.
Unanimously.
Thank you.
Is there a second
Randy.
For Jackie's motion to adjourn?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Michelle.